Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody. This is JT Patton, and this is Hot Wash After Action Book Report, where we try to give readers and writers a bit of a different spin on some of today's writers and the authentic aspects that they bring to their thrillers, novels, what have you. Today we have Chuck Farr, and who has a real interesting new book out. Chuck, welcome, and thanks for joining us today. Congratulations on launch day for you.
Thanks, GT. Good to talk to you.
Before we get in, now I've got a little bit of your bio posted on the site, but you know, if you would, you know, give us what you want us to hear a little bit about your background today before we dive into some of the meat of the show.
Well, I've got a kind of a very checkered background, and everyone at home listening to this, I will tell you, definitely don't try this at home, and don't let your kid do it. A million years ago, I was a Navy brat living in Newport, Rhode Island. My father was a professor at the Naval War College. And in high school, some of you guys may have skipped English, but in high school, living in New England, where I was an avid surfer, I used to skip weeks of school at a time, and became known in my paperwork as an incorrigible truant. Well, one day I came home, and some of you may have run into this yourself. I came home, and on the dining room table were four catalogs of four military academies in the United States. And being the flippant kind of jerk I was, I walked up to the gray one, stuck my finger on it, and said, "How about this one?" And it turned out to be Stanton Military Academy in Stanton, Virginia, the oldest military prep school in the nation, and I think all of our graduates would agree it was the toughest one. And I spent 3 years there as a rat and then a cadet, learning essentially high-pressure janitorial work. But it really turned my life around, because I went from being kind of a surfer bum to realizing, as a lot of people in the military do, just how valuable 5 minutes of time was. Yeah. And although my dad was in the military, in fact, I became a fourth-generation naval officer. After Stanton, I thought I didn't want to have anything to do with the Navy at all. I had an appointment to Annapolis in the class of 79, where I have several of my SEAL friends. I was appointed to that class, but ran as far as I could. I went to Cal State Northridge in Los Angeles, where I studied clinical psychology, and thought I was going to wind up with a PhD and a practice in the suburbs and telling rich ladies not to be afraid of spiders. But about halfway through my master's degree, I just something in me kind of snapped, and I decided all at once that I wanted to try to be a Navy SEAL. And I, you know, put in my paperwork. Of course, they said everybody wants to be a Navy SEAL. Good luck. But I was very lucky that the BUDS class, two BUDS classes ahead of me, all of the officers quit. They were all ROTC guys from like Duke and much better schools, Notre Dame, et cetera. And it was decided that they were going to give a chance to college athletes. So in my BUDS class, 114, they rounded up a bunch of college jocks. I didn't exactly consider myself a college jock, but I had rowed crew, and I was a fencer, believe it or not, an NCAA fencer.
Okay.
But somehow, 6 months later, I was among the few who graduated, and I was off in a SEAL career. This was in the 80s was my active service, and I was pretty much, I was at SEAL Team 4, so I was pretty much in and out of every place that wasn't nice in Central America.
Yeah.
El Salvador and Honduras, especially for me, although Panama as well. And, of course, once the Navy trains you up as a crack jungle operator, it's time for them to send you to, that's right, folks, Beirut, Lebanon.
Yep.
And I was the executive officer of the multinational peacekeeping force, the Special Warfare Detachment. To it, we were there on October 23rd, 1983, that was the day that the Marine barracks was bombed. So I got to see a pretty awful slice of the Lebanese Civil War. After that, I was selected to go to Dev Group, at the time called SEAL Team 6, and I spent the rest of my naval career at SEAL Team 6.
Fantastic.
That's what Uncle Sam got out of me.
Well, I know that others have gotten a lot out of you as well, from Hollywood to a lot of your contributions and writing, you've ranged from your biography to some aspects of what some would say even conspiratorial or reporting, from your whichever vantage you want to take. You've got the newest thriller out, or the newest book on Philip Nolan, The Man Without a Country. And, anyone who's looking at your website, Twitter feeds, or even the Amazon page, I have to admit that I fell into the same thing where, looks like Chuck's got some interest in some boats and sea. And admittedly, I didn't really know much about Philip Nolan and the original Atlantic Monthly article during the Civil War. So, I didn't have time to read this. We did this one kind of a quick ad hoc. And so all of a sudden I went through and started reading up on Philip Nolan. And I was really taken aback about the story. And, you've got in here the themes of the duty, loyalty, and the meaning of patriotism. And here during the election time, we're looking at a country that, in many cases, quite divided, whether it's across party lines, race, economic differences. And you go back to Philip Nolan and the intent of the writing, and you've got a lot of these celebrities who are talking about, if Trump is elected, I'm moving to Canada. If Hillary's elected, I'm moving to Canada. And I caught a quote from Philip Nolan, The Man Without a Country, in the Atlantic Monthly, that I'll share, which was, "Behind all these men is the country herself, your country, and you belong to her as you belong to your own mother." And thinking about what would it be like if somebody actually did turn their back on the country, or worse, in this case, if the country turned its back on the individual. And something that I don't think people should take as lightly as they do in their flippant comments, but this is your show, so I'm not going to ramble on. I think it's important for a lot of people to hear about this story and the fact that it's not just a swashbuckler and a tall ship story, but there's so much more behind it. And I think, given your background, I think it adds much more to it, given the duty, loyalty, and patriotism that you've been involved with as a naval officer. So let me turn the show back over to you, Chuck.
Oh, wow. Well, that sort of nailed it completely. Since we're dropping quotes on it, there's a quote that begins Philip Nolan, and it's from Euripides in 300 B.C. And he said, Oh, let death deliver me and bring my days to their fatal end, for there's no affliction worse than losing one's own country. And, in Philip Nolan, again, its wrappings appear to be a tale of tall ships and the American Navy fighting the Barbary pirates in the 1820s in the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
But what I really tried to do is take a modern day thriller and wrap it up in this old venue. We have the Defense Appropriations Act, which some patriot listeners may realize, that suspends habeas corpus and allows the government, the military, to take a citizen of the United States prisoner and hold them without trial and without charges, which is antithetical to everything in our Constitution and everything in our social compact between ourselves and our government. What happens in Philip Nolan is, back in 1807, Mr. Nolan was embroiled, associated with Aaron Burr's plot to invade the lands of the Louisiana Purchase. We won't go through everything about Mr. Aaron Burr, but what happens to Philip Nolan is he is court-martialed after Burr is acquitted. So the charges are flowing downhill. And he's asked at his sentencing, is there anything he wants to say to prove his loyalty to the United States? Now, Nolan, at this point, has been arrested, held without charge for months, now charged on charges that the principal has been acquitted of, and asked about the United States. Philip Nolan answers, "God damn the United States. I never want to hear those two words again as long as I live." In this case, the judges come back and they say, "That is your sentence." They strip him of his rank. They break his sword. They put him on the next Navy ship sailing into the Atlantic. And for the rest of his life, Philip Nolan sails around the world, transferred from ship to ship, never to hear the words United States said in his presence, never to receive or write a letter, and never to see the country again. And he is held as a secret prisoner. So I always loved that story as a boy, and I thought, what if Tom Clancy was retelling the story of Philip Nolan? You know, some of the things that happen in Philip Nolan, Man Without a Country, my book, we have a Russian ship transferring arms into the Mediterranean to some outlaw bandit states of Barbary pirates in North Africa, and shipping 42-pound cannons to them covered in Ukrainian wheat. Those are transferred by the Portuguese Navy, put ashore in these Arab fortresses. We have American ships being hijacked at sea and their prisoners transported across the desert and sold piecemeal through international banking houses. We have hostage rescues, hostage dramas, hijacked ships, pirates, international arms trafficking, but it all takes place in 1827. And all of it is framed with a protagonist who his country has done everything they can to erase him. And he's put in a position later to help it or to just watch these things happen. And the ties of country and the love of country and the complicated emotion of patriotism, you know, it takes root in him and he does something. He's not a man who does nothing, but he does something. And his response is complicated as well. Because, you know, there was a saying we used to have in the SEAL teams, you might be willing to die for your country, but your country isn't going to die for you. And are you still willing to make a sacrifice knowing that math? You know, so that's what I tried to put into Philip Nolan. I hope I did.
Well, it sounds fantastic. And the you know, it's just before I could get it, my hands on the copy, just quickly going through it. I mean, it's beautifully written, very detailed. I mean, it's fantastic read so far. And then layering over, you know, just the themes of it. You know, I think it's certainly very appropriate for today, and one of those easy books to recommend to others simply because of the messaging, and again of what you bring to the storytelling. Is there, you know, it's when you talk about the hidden shipments that are going on. I mean, there, you know from being a warrior that. We often don't learn from the lessons of the past to deal with the future, and we're currently dealing with so many of these issues even today. Was there, you know, more of a purpose to you also writing this book and, you know, trying to create just an example, a little story that so resonates to some of the issues that are coming about today, hoping to draw some attention to that, or what was the purpose of coming up with a story beyond, you know, something that was a childhood favorite and, you know, a good overall tale?
You know, I really did want to say something about, you know, when there, we have what we hope is a community of nations, and there are political entities, countries, places in the world that stand outside of the community, you know, what we call at this point failed nations. And they operate beyond the conventions of normal intercourse between states. they don't declare war on someone else. They simply go out and act. They, you know, in this case, we're talking about the historical Barbary states, which were along the, in the Maghreb, the same Maghreb we deal with now on the north coast of Africa. There were city-states there, collectively called by United States history as the Barbary Pirates. But these were sovereign city-states with very good sailors, very good ships, very good navigators, and they made much of their national income by sailing out into the oceans, the Atlantic and the Mediterranean principally, and taking slaves and capturing ships. And, you know, a bit unknown, not really recognized so much in history, but there were over 10 million Europeans captured by these Arab slave traders, by ships that raided as far north as Ireland, and even into Holland, and not just taking people off ships, but going ashore, encircling towns, and marching everyone out. And so again, you know, we had at one point Thomas Jefferson trying to deal with this problem, and it was Jefferson who said, "Millions for defense, but not a penny in tribute." Of course, he said that, but then they went ahead and paid the Barbary states, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, and gave them ships in order for them to stop preying on American ships in the Mediterranean. Finally, that deal broke down. You know, you need only to look at intransigent states like North Korea or, you know, Libya formerly, or Syria today, or Iran, that the more you give them, the more they want, and the less you're going to influence their conduct. And finally, Jefferson had enough, and he sent an expeditionary force to deal with the Barbary states. And from that, we have Stephen Decatur's very famous raid into Tripoli Harbor to capture, recapture the United States frigate Philadelphia. Decatur went in there under cover of darkness in a captured enemy vessel, pretended to be a returning corsair, and got aboard the USS Philadelphia, liberated its prisoners, and then burned the ship to the waterline, but got away with all the prisoners. This was in the late 1700s, and no less than Admiral Lord Nelson called it the most bold and daring act of the age. So if you think of that now, as that could have been a SEAL Team 6 operation. And you had an intransigent nation outside of the community of nations. You had a rogue state capturing American prisoners and wanting to ransom them off piecemeal. So again, I just thought, we have all the elements of the year 2012, but we have them 200 years ago. In 1827, this stuff was happening. And it was just fascinating to me. I wanted to combine, let's say, Tom Clancy with Patrick O'Brien, who, of course, wrote the 21 volumes of the Aubrey Maturin series, which I just loved. And I'm in withdrawal because Mr. O'Brien has died and left us all bereft.
Not to turn this political, because I do want to, you know, continue your thoughts on the book and what you brought to it. But do you think that we are being as aggressive as we should be today to deal with a lot of these threats? Do you think that we are being as daring as we should be? I mean, you've been tip of the spear and one of the pointiest ends of it. Are we using our full capabilities as we should in your eyes?
Well, I don't think we're using our full capabilities, but I'd also say this. It's, you know, when to most American minds, you hear of the civil war in Syria, and it's easy to think, well, there must be a blue side and a gray side, when in fact there are 12 sides. You know, there are, it's even more complicated than that. There are, you know, there are three or four different gradations of Islamic fundamentalists. There are increasingly hapless and ill-trained Free Syrian Army brigades that are supposed to bring truth, justice, and the American way when they ring, when they win. But what often happens is they get trained and equipped and given state-of-the-art American equipment, and they quickly go over to al-Nusra or the Islamic State. You've got the Assad regime, nominally the the government of record. They're not afraid to use chemical weapons on their own people, cluster bombs, barrel bombs. You know, Mr. Assad is the latest son of a generations-long crime family that has been foisted on Syria. His father, Hafez Assad, in the 80s completely destroyed the city of Homs, surrounded it with bulldozers, and then lobbed thousands and thousands of artillery shells in it until he killed everyone in the city. So this is the kind of leader that Assad is. You have Russia that has a $1 trillion investment in Syria. Russia has been providing the Syrian government since the 70s with the best radar, the best fighter planes, the best ballistic missile technology that it can. So Syria owes Putin trillions of dollars. And if he were to allow Mr. Assad to make an exit, all that money would be a sunk cost. It's unfathomable to the normal civilian to realize that both Russian and American planes, as we speak, are carrying out airstrikes in Syria. It mm-hmm. is just an unfathomable mess. I don't like to pat myself on the back, but I survived one of those wars in Lebanon where there were three armies of occupation, the Syrians, the Israelis, and the Americans, seven nations of a peacekeeping force, four different iterations of the PLO, the Lebanese army, Hezbollah, Iranian saboteurs, and thrown into the mix self-starting lone wolf suicide bombers that were happy to walk into any bank, concert, gathering of people, demonstration. And, you know, it hasn't happened yet in Syria, but what happened in Lebanon and in Beirut in particular eventually was the breakdown of all society, and it became essentially like Mad Max. There were portions of Beirut that looked like the moon, and if you stuck your head up out of the rubble, somebody would blow it out. It was like a post-apocalyptic nightmare. You know, Beirut largely has come back from that. But one of the reasons it has, now I'm not praising Hezbollah at all, but one of the reasons it has is Hezbollah keeps a tight thumb down on its people and anyone else who gets out of line. You know, Hezbollah is fully armed by the nation of Iran, and Hezbollah does what Iran wants it to do. So should there be some sort of Pax Americana in the Middle East? I don't think it's possible.
So with those experiences that you've had, looking to see who is the enemy, who is an ally, who can you count on? I kind of take you back to the book. And in Philip Nolan, you know, what do you think that you also bring to that story? I mean, I know you've mentioned that there's a lot of different kind of adventurous aspects to it. There is the espionage element to it. You know, there is the covert shipping elements to it, you know, that you've been able to experience and then take historically. You know, what do you think are some of the more authentic aspects of, you know, this book taking story in the 1800s that, you know, that comes from Chuck, who has been involved in a number of different conflicts, and you can, you know, bring that knowledge and bring a lot of the emotion also to a story like that.
Well, you know, and I think anyone who's brushed up against combat realizes pretty quickly that you feel like you're in this not for your country anymore, but you're in it for your friends. And you're in it, if you're in the Navy, you're in it for your shipmates. And, you know, there's an interesting thing about naval combat is that a soldier will fight on many battlefields, but he'll almost never fight on the same battlefield twice. But a sailor always fights on the same battlefield. He fights with his ship, and he fights with his shipmates. And when a soldier dies, they bury him, and the regiment marches on. But when a fellow sailor dies, you're right there, and you see his empty hammock, and you see his empty place at the mess table. And that tends to bring these men closer and closer together. Now, in Nolan's case, it turns out the ship that he's on is all that he has, because he doesn't have a country anymore. And the other thing is that, you know, Nolan has traveled through dozens of ships by the time we meet him. He's been confined for 20 years. And on some ships, he's treated very badly indeed. They consider him a traitor. They keep him in irons. On other ships, he's allowed just a little bit of freedom. On one or two of the ships that he was on, they didn't even feed him. He had to eat what he could of flying fish that came up onto the deck at night. And he many times had to eat them raw by slicing them up and kind of dusting them with powdered mustard. But aboard this last ship that he's on, USS Enterprise, which is a sister ship to Constitution, he gets treated fairly well. And the ship and Mr. Nolan go through some combat together. And in a final, when this story comes to a head, Nolan is faced with, what do I do? Do I run and get my own freedom? Do I turn my back on all the hurt and injury that's done to me? Or do I think, as some philosopher once said, that, you know, I one man is nothing more than an atom of his country? Just like you mentioned before, I'm one of those guys that think it makes up all of us. It is what we are. You know, you're an American, you can try to become a Canadian. You know, you can move to France if the person you like doesn't get elected. Or you can stay with the ship. You know, I'm not the kind of guy who jumps ship, I guess I would say.
Yeah. You know, we've only got a couple minutes left, so it may cut us off here, but I think it still will record some of it. I'm going to get a little personal on something. You know, and forgive me if it's a little too raw, but, you know, you are one of the few guys that I've ever seen come out with a book who has received negative reviews of that book before people have even read it, and admittedly written negative things into their book where they've, you know, maybe it's been conspiratorial, and they've said, you know, I haven't read this book, but, you know, this is garbage and that. And I suspect that, you know, you've also gotten some heat in the community from some of your writings. How much of Philip Nolan did you sometimes feel in writing it in aspects of where maybe some of your brothers have turned their back, or some other fellow community members have, you know, tried to disavow some of what you've done?
Well, the interesting thing was, you know, no matter what the critics were saying, my teammates never turned their back on me. Some people said they did, but I am still part of the community. I still am asked to speak at community events. I still am invited to community briefings. So that didn't happen. You know, the problem was I told the story that the operators on the ground told me, and it didn't agree with what the White House said. You know, one of the other things I got heat for is, you know, don't believe Chuck Farr's WMD hype in SEAL Target Geronimo. Well, it was just 3 days ago that the New York Times released a documentary film about the 5,000 chemical weapons that were found in Iraq. And the CIA has admitted that there was an active buyback program. And also, people were treated for nerve gas exposure in Iraq. So it was very important, I think, for the administration to clobber me at that period. But, you know, look, they did some damage to me, but the truth is the truth. And, you know, the guys on the ground told me the truth, JT, and I passed it on. And I'm still part of the tribe.
That's great. Well, you can the book is now available as of today, from what I understand. Is there anything else you can share as far as details as to where you recommend people to pick up your book from? And, you know, audio, I understand, is also now out?
Yep, absolutely. It's of course, on Amazon. It's from the Naval Institute Press. It's Philip Nolan, The Man Without a Country. It's on Kindle. It's got a great audiobook. It's available in bookstores nationwide.
Well, thanks so much. I appreciate you joining the show and sharing your candid thoughts on the matter. And I wish you all the success in this book, and I can't wait to pick it up.
Thanks, JT. Thank you very much for having me, and congratulations on Prime Charge. It'll be out soon, too.
Thanks so much. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.